So last night, our family pulled into our driveway after spending a week in the sunny southern state of Florida. There's nothing like skipping right over spring and into summer. You go from winter to like 28 degrees and sunny. It is awesome. It's an incredible experience. But there's also something meaningful about slowly progressing in order. You know, numerous times while we were away, Melissa's like, why don't we live here all the time? And I'm like, because we wouldn't appreciate it, right? You wouldn't. I mean, there's something about, you know, having days like this where it's like ridiculous, and all of a sudden it starts getting warmer outside, and all of a sudden you start to slowly work into spring, and then eventually you find yourself in summer. There's something about the seasons of the year. Well, I want to begin this morning as with a bit of an introduction to a season of the year that we're entering into this week. Since the 4th century, Christians of many traditions have set aside a period of time leading up to Easter for a focused time of focused spiritual development. It's a season known as Lent. So Lent is a season that gets underway this week. Now, before Lent arrives, there is Mardi Gras, right? Now, this is not something that's necessarily celebrated around here as much. It's too cold to wear outfits like that at this time of year. So instead of Mardi Gras, with the big parties and the music and the clothing and everything else, we eat pancakes. I know it's close. We eat pancakes. We do this on the Tuesday before Lent begins as a way of basically saying, we're going to gorge ourselves and then we'll be disciplined. But first, we're going to gorge ourselves. And so actually, this is kind of an announcement too, because on Tuesday night between 5 and 6:30, we're going to be flipping pancakes and cooking up sausages here in the gym. So come on by at any time during that window. You don't have to arrive right at 5, but any time in that window, come on by. And we're going to eat pancakes together and we're going to gorge ourselves right before we enter into this season of Lent. So what is Lent all about? It is a 40-day period that begins on a day known as Ash Wednesday. That is March 1st this week, so this coming Wednesday. And it ends the Saturday before Easter, which this year falls on April 15th. Lent is a time for those who are maybe on the outskirts or feel like you're looking in on the church or looking in on Christianity from the outside. This is a time for focused spiritual consideration. To say, you know what, here's as good a time as any for me to really dedicate myself to exploring this faith and really considering whether this is something I can orient my life around. For those who have already made that decision, Lent becomes a time of renewing Christian commitment, of deepening faith, of committing ourselves anew to the things that we may have committed ourselves already to in the past. Now, traditionally, people choose to give something up during this period to illustrate their devotion to following Christ. So maybe it's giving up chocolate, or maybe it's giving up watching television, or maybe it's even something as crazy as giving up drinking coffee. Wow, that was interesting. So it's a time where we say, okay, for this like period leading up to Easter, I'm going to actually let go of something that kind of matters to me, something that I'm going to notice on a regular part of my life. Now, here's the bonus. The bonus is that, because you think, I could never do that, like the person in the back say. I could never do that. Sundays are exempt from this fast because every Sunday of the year is like a mini Easter, okay? So you're not supposed to be fasting on a Sunday. We celebrate every single Sunday. And so Sundays, like, that's the time where you can like drink 6 cups of coffee if you really want. But the rest of the days, we give something up. Well, what is the point? Will this really make me more spiritual? Well, in Lent, by denying ourselves something that we enjoy, we discipline our will so that we are not ruled by our pleasures. We give up something that we do enjoy as a way of saying to ourselves, self, I can do without this. I'm actually in control here. I don't need to be ruled by my passions and my desires. But what's so bad about eating chocolate or watching TV? Well, nothing. That's kind of the point. If you're doing something bad and are thinking about giving it up for Lent, just give it up now. Don't wait till Wednesday. Just give it up now. And don't stop at Easter. Just keep giving it up. The point is we're looking for something that isn't bad at all, but it's something that we will notice missing from our lives. It's not about what you give up. It's about what you gain. And by training ourselves to resist temptations when they're not harmful or sinful, we train ourselves to reject temptations when they are harmful or sinful. Richard Foster, who did a lot of writing around fasting, he said that fasting, which is this idea of letting something go and giving something up for spiritual purposes, fasting helps us keep our balance in life. And so that's what this is about. This isn't about giving up something that's wrong. It's about saying, I need to have a better balance in my life, and so I want to do this for a season. Denying ourselves things of lesser priority shows us that they are not, in fact, necessary, at which point we can begin to focus on what is necessary. And so I want to put that challenge out there to our community, as we do every year at this time, to say, think about something that you could give up during this season of Lent. And it's an exercise that we can do together as well. Now, we're going to try something a little different this year. We're going to continue to encourage one another to give something up during Lent, but I also want us to take something new on this season. And so if you got a program when you came in this morning, there's a little insert that you noticed there, and I'm going to explain what this is. This is an exercise called Lectio Divina, which is a Latin phrase which means divine reading. This is a way of engaging with the Bible in a reflective way to really pay attention to how God is speaking to us and how he is calling us to live and what he might be saying to us. And so the idea is that it's explained on the front side of what you do. You kind of prepare yourselves. You read the passage slowly. You kind of pay attention to what God might be saying in this passage. It's not about doing a kind of historical study of it. It's not trying to so much figure out what is it telling you to do. It's more listening to how God is speaking to you through this passage of Scripture. Maybe there's a word that really jumps out at you. Maybe there's a phrase and you feel like, I wonder, could God actually be trying to communicate to me through Scripture? And so that's what Lectio Divina is about. And so what we're going to do is, this is something we're going to encourage everyone to do together during the season of Lent. So this first week is a little bit different, but basically the way the rhythm is going to go is on a Wednesday, so this Wednesday begins, we're going to pray through a psalm every Wednesday. The psalms are basically the prayer book of the ancient Israelites, and they continue to be a resource for us to learn how to pray well. And so on Wednesday, we're going to learn how to pray through the psalms. And then for the Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, we're going to begin to reflect on, in this process of Lectio Divina, the passage that is going to be the focus of our gathering on Sunday morning. And so during those days, we'll read through parts of that passage together. And then on the other side of Sunday, on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, we'll continue to reflect on what we've talked about in our gathering on Sunday. And that kind of pattern will continue through the season of Lent. So it's going to be an opportunity for us again to do something together, to focus on what God might be sharing to us. It's not a giant commitment of time. If you take a look here, like Thursday, March 2nd, the reading is one verse. So it's like one sentence. And the idea is to read it and to focus on it. It's not a really time-consuming exercise, but we believe it's something that could bring some life and vitality to our faith during this season of the year. So I'd encourage you also to think about, if you're part of a small group, maybe on the day that you gather, you do this together. That might be a neat way to try it. Or perhaps families or roommates, maybe try to do it at least some points during the week together and kind of share your reflections with one another. Or you can do it on your own if you're more comfortable with that. So I would encourage you to participate in this, both the Lectio Divina and the concept of giving something else up during the season of Lent. I'd encourage you to do this as long as it's a part of a greater commitment, not to do religious things, but to know God. I'm going to invite Mel to come up and read this morning's passages from Scripture for us.
Our first reading is from Ecclesiastes 12. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. When the grinders cease because they are few and those looking through the windows grow dim. When the doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. When people rise up at the sound of birds, but all their songs grow faint. When people are afraid of heights and of dangers in the street, when the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire no longer is stirred. Then people go to their eternal home, and mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, before the pitcher is shattered at the spring and the well wheel broken at the well, and the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. Matthew 11. Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am humble and gentle in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come. There's all kinds of wonderful imagery in this passage, and you may have picked up on some of it, or you may not have, I'm not sure. The keepers of the house trembling, a reference to their bones trembling in old age. When strong men stoop, imagine our shoulders stooping. When the grinders cease, our teeth don't work anymore. When those looking through windows grow dim, when our eyes can't see clearly. When the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and desire is no longer stirred. Well, you can figure that one out on your own. The assumption is that the days of trouble are inevitable. Oh, things are easy when you're young, the teacher says. But just wait, the days of trouble are coming. A few years ago, I remember Melissa and I having this conversation, and she was saying, like it just seems like so many things are not going well. Like, we're seeing people's marriages fall apart, and we're seeing people's health failing, and we're seeing people losing their jobs, and we're seeing people struggling with addiction. We're just, like, everything is just kind of falling apart. Like, what is going on? Why is all this stuff happening? And if you were talking about it, we were reflecting on the fact that it was really just life. I remember saying that I think the reason that more things are happening is that we've been alive longer. I think that's all there is to it. I don't think there's any kind of magical formula or anything kind of strange going on, except for the fact that we've been alive longer. And the longer that you are alive, the more bad things you're going to experience around you. And then just practically speaking, I mean, marriage gets harder after a few years. Your body gets more difficult to work properly after a few years. You know, their career maybe becomes not as exciting as it was at the beginning. There are so many things that just plain and simply are affected negatively by time itself. I can remember when I was in high school, in my bedroom at home, I would put little post-it notes up on the wall with quotes that were really inspiring to me. This has been a long-standing thing. I'm really inspired by stuff. And one of the first ones that I put up there on a little post-it note was a quote from a writer named Oswald Chambers. He was a Christian author. He actually died quite young in life, but he wrote some profound things. And this one I'm going to share with you is actually, I think, as I was reflecting on this, one of the more formational quotes that I would have read at that point in my life. He said, "Much that we call the trial of faith is the inevitable result of being alive." And the reason that affected me so much was it was kind of a reflection of what the teacher in Ecclesiastes is saying, is that life just happens. Sometimes when things happen to us, we try to figure out the big why to it. Why has this happened? And Chambers suggests, because that's what life is. Life is about things going great, and it's about things falling apart. And it's not necessarily a trial of faith. God isn't necessarily trying to teach you a lesson. He isn't abandoning you or celebrating you, but it's just the way life works. As valuable as it can be to ask difficult why questions, and I think we ought to ask those questions, Are we prepared to acknowledge that much of the time life just moves in a direction that doesn't sit well with us? Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. Isn't that perfect? Oh, gosh. But the honest truth is that simply being alive can wear a person's faith down. You may say, oh, this isn't a trial of faith, it's just the inevitable result of being alive. But it becomes a trial of faith because the difficulties of life can weigh our spiritual lives down. Thomas Merton, in his book New Seeds of Contemplation, wrote, too often, the weakest thing about our faith is the illusion that our faith is strong. When the strength we feel is only the intensity of emotion or sentiment, which have nothing to do with real faith. How many people there are in the world of today who have lost their faith along with the vain hopes and illusions of their childhood? What they called faith was just one among all the other illusions. Merton's point is that faith is every bit as much about the stooping shoulders and fading eyesight as it is about youthful health and vigor. It's every bit as much about the darkness as it is about the light, the pain as it is the joy, the suffering as it is the success. A truly strong faith, then, is a faith that can admit to its weakness, a faith that can say, I'm tired. I don't have it in me right now. In fact, one might ask whether a faith that can't admit to its weakness is a real faith at all. A number of years ago, a book came out, Come Be My Light, a collection of writings between Mother Teresa and a close companion of hers. Now, she had said during her lifetime to this companion, do not, under any circumstances, publish what I'm sharing with you. And after her death, he decided to break that commitment he'd made to her and publish these works. And he explains his rationale for it, that the writings and the correspondence between them were too valuable for the world to be kept secret and kept private. And so he published these writings. You may remember the headlines. I remember looking at the newspaper that the headline right across the top said, I have no faith, Mother Teresa. Because that's a quote from one of the letters that she wrote. Because this book was a collection of these letters back and forth where she described her spiritual fatigue, her this distance that she felt from God, this complete lack of any kind of communication with God for decades of her life, this darkness, this heaviness, this despair that she felt. And the reason that these were published was because her friend knew that so many people needed to hear that someone like Mother Teresa experienced spiritual fatigue and experienced the darkness and the distance. She wrote in one place, I am told God loves me, and yet the reality of darkness and coldness and emptiness is so great that nothing touches my soul. Have you ever had that kind of feeling? Or are you maybe having it right now? Well, you're not alone. It's the point of publishing Mother Teresa's writings, but it's not anything new, really. When I saw that headline, I wasn't like, oh no, another scandal for the church. I was like, this is beautiful. This is the gospel. This is what Christianity is all about. Because it's always been about that. Listen to Paul writing in his letter to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, he just talked about these revelations that God had given him. He says, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Paul continues, "Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." This is such a powerful passage of Scripture. God's response to him as he begged and pleaded to get through this difficulty that he was in the middle of, God's response to him was, "My grace is sufficient for you. My grace is enough for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. And so your weakness is an opportunity for my power to be demonstrated in your life." But we're not used to hearing about weakness being a good thing. We're asked to create a password on a website, and we type in 123456, and we get this message spat, "weak." So we try another password, password, "weak." Must be stronger. We're told we must be stronger. Weakness isn't a good thing. And here we have Paul telling us that weakness is something to get excited about because it's an opportunity for God to show up. The 16th century Spanish mystic St. John of the Cross referred to an experience that he called the dark night of the soul. Now, when we think about a dark night, there's basically one of two things that come to mind. One is a dark night. The second is Batman. But St. John of the Cross was talking about something different. He was talking about the dark night of the soul. For him, a dark night was a spiritual one, a dark fire that one had to walk through in order to truly experience what he called the divine union of perfect love. I want to read just a brief paragraph. "Although this happy night brings darkness to the spirit, it does so only to give it light in everything. And although it humbles it and makes it miserable, it does so only to exalt it and to raise it up. And although it impoverishes it and empties it of all natural affection and attachment, it does so only that it may enable it to stretch forward divinely and thus to have fruition and experience of all things, both above and below." For St. John of the Cross, this dark night experience was something that shouldn't be run away from, but it's something that should be embraced and understood, that it's only through this kind of spiritual fatigue that we experience that we're able to experience other aspects of who God is, this fullness of life from above and from below. It's a wordy passage, to be sure, but he has an important message for a culture like ours that does everything possible to avoid dark nights, to live in perpetual sunlight. Seriously, ask yourself, when was the last time you intentionally did something difficult? When was the last time you chose to do something that you would probably fail at? Something that was beyond your ability? Something that would likely not work out well? Something that would cause you pain or discomfort? We don't do this. When it gets dark, we turn the lights on. When something's uncomfortable, we get to remove ourselves from the situation. But he's telling us that this experience of this dark night of the soul, this negativity, this feeling of a distance from God, of God being silent, this experience is actually a really good thing for us. And we actually do ourselves harm by trying to avoid it or walking away too soon. He goes on to say that he who refuses to go forth in the night to seek the beloved and to be stripped of his own will and mortified, but seeks him upon his bed and at his own convenience, will not succeed in finding him. For this soul, referring to himself, this soul says of itself that it found him by going forth in the dark with yearnings of love. He says our tendency is only to seek God when things are going well, or to seek God in the ways that we want to, maybe in the comforts of church or in a certain place where we like to have a quiet time. But he says we need to also seek God in the difficult places and in the trying times. That's how we find God, going forth in the dark with yearnings of love. When God seems distant, when prayer seems empty, when we don't have the willpower to overcome temptation, when the Bible bores us, when we don't want to talk to the people sitting in the pew next to us, when we are spiritually tired, what do we do? I was reading about experience of farmers in the Midwest, and this may be true today, but at least it was a number of years ago, where they would, in the midst of winter, have especially dangerous blizzards that would blow through. And here's like an old photo. And you can see the house is covered to the peak of the roof. The hydro lines, the drifts of snow are as high as hydro lines in some places. And when a blizzard like this would be coming through, something that would happen, it's because a farmer would still have to take care of his livestock, and so we'd have to make that journey from the house out to the barn, and he'd have to secure things in the barn. But sometimes these blizzards would roll in so quickly that the farmer would not actually be able to see his house from the barn, even though it's maybe from the front to the back of the sanctuary away. And so what had happened in different cases is that when the blizzard subsided and the snow drifted away or melted away, the farmer would be found sometimes 20 feet away from the door of his house, frozen to death in his own yard, because he couldn't find the way, sometimes would spend hours walking in circles. And so the advice and the practice of farmers was to when the warnings of blizzards were coming, was to tie a rope from the back of the house to the barn door, and so that you could safely travel from one place to the next through this raging blizzard, knowing that you were going in the right direction. There is a safe way through the storm of spiritual fatigue. But we like to try other ways. We like to try to make our way from the barn to the house, so to speak, on our own. Thomas Merton says that spiritual fatigue proceeds from wasted and ill-applied effort. The disgust it generates slackens the power of our soul, so that we waste even more effort and end in even greater fatigue. He talks about the fact that there are all kinds of things we do when we experience this spiritual fatigue, this darkness of our soul. And the fact is when we try the wrong things, it just makes the situation worse. It makes the night darker. It makes the weight heavier. And then so we try something else that doesn't work, and it makes it darker still, and it makes it heavier still. And eventually we just say, forget the whole thing. One approach we take is to push aside the very real emotions we're feeling. But that can be dangerous. To try to ignore the fact that we feel distant from God, or the fact that we feel discouraged in our faith. Brené Brown writes that you cannot selectively numb emotion. When we numb the dark emotion, when we numb vulnerability and fear and the shame of not being good enough, we by default numb joy. And so here's an example of trying something. Well, I'll deal with this spiritual fatigue by pretending it's not there. But in order to numb the fact that it's not there, we also numb the joy that we need to continue on in a life of faith. Some of us try to serve our way through. And serving is a good thing and is something that we should do during times of darkness. But if we think that it's going to get us through the night, we're wrong. Some of us try to argue our way through. And intellectual thought and argument is something that we should do when we have challenging questions. We should, but it's not going to get us through the dark night. Some of us try to be positive until the storm blows over. And being positive and holding on to hope is valuable, but it's not going to be enough to get us through the dark night. St. John writes about our tendency to flee from the things that are most valuable for our spiritual well-being, while we cling to the very things that trip us up at every step. But what should we do? If we shouldn't be trying all of these things to get ourselves out of the dark night, what do we do? Well, this is where our second reading comes in. Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." Now, if that's the answer, I can see that being problematic to someone who might say the whole point is that I don't feel like coming to Jesus, and that's supposed to be the solution. I don't believe in God. I'm supposed to trust in him. That doesn't work. Does it bother you that Jesus proposes such a simple solution to our weariness, to our heaviness, and to our darkness? Does it bother you that he says, "Come to me"? Kind of bothers me. I wish it was something more tangible. 3 steps. Even I'd be willing even to go 7 steps, you know, just to know that if I did these things, then I would get myself through this stage. Something I could have a little more control over. But Jesus says, "Come to me." He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. It's such an odd juxtaposition. And I put this picture up here just so we understand what a yoke is. I mean, this is what Jesus would have been referring to. So you imagine Jesus as one of these animals here with his head through this yoke, and he's saying, hey, the best way to deal with all of this heaviness and weariness you're feeling is to get in here with me. Like, it's kind of weird, isn't it? Like, here. Like, these are beasts of burden. Their whole existence is like doing hard work. And Jesus is like, you want to deal with all the crap you're going on in your life here? Here, get ready for some hard work. Come on in here with me. But the thing about this hard work, once you strap this thing on with me, it's easy and it's light. It's hard for us to get our head around this, but it's easy and it's light because we're yoked together with Jesus. I want to read a passage from Watchman Nee's book, The Normal Christian Life. He says, we would like to have death and resurrection put together within 1 hour of each other. We cannot face the thought that God will keep us aside for so long a time. We cannot bear to wait. And of course, I cannot tell you how long he will take. But in principle, I think it's quite safe to say this, that there will be a definite period when he will keep you there. It will seem as though nothing is happening, as though everything you valued is slipping from your grasp. There confronts you a blank wall with no door in it. Seemingly, everyone else is being blessed and used, while you yourself have been passed by and are losing out. Lie quiet. All is in darkness, but it is only for a night. It must indeed be a full night. But that is all. Afterwards, you will find that everything is given back to you in glorious resurrection, and nothing can measure the difference between what was before and what now is. There are going to be dark times, silent times, distant times. Our invitation is to cling to God in the midst of them. I saw this a week and a half ago when Steve and I went to London to visit the Skopniks in the hospital just 3 days after Ashlyn's accident. I mean, can you even fathom the heaviness and the darkness that you'd be walking through? And the thing that really struck me, specifically, you know, in talking with Gordon Sharon, was their ability to both acknowledge the very real circumstances that are going on. I mean, standing there in that alongside that hospital bed, you can't ignore what's happening. And they were able to articulate that they understood what the likely outcome was, or what some of the likely outcomes could be. But the overarching narrative for them was a belief that God can do the impossible. They were very well aware of what was likely going to happen, but they were rooted and planted in the prayers of God's people. And not a sentence that would go by where they were talking about the health situation or the doctor's diagnosis where they wouldn't remind us that people all over this world were praying and that they believed that God would hear the prayers of his people. Like, that is clinging to God in the midst of a dark night. It's not about ignoring what's going on around us, but it's about clinging fast to God in the midst of it. St. John of the Cross writes, if trials come to the soul believes it will never escape from them. Now that all its blessings are now over. Or, if spiritual blessings come, the soul believes in the same way that its troubles are now over and that blessings will never fail it. But neither of these beliefs are true. What's true is that God will be with us in whatever crises, trials, darkness, as well as in whatever celebrations, victories, and brightly lit days. That's what's true. Do you not know, the prophet Isaiah wrote, have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. God offers us himself. The one who does not grow tired or weary offers us his strength and power when we are weary and weak. Returning to the blizzard analogy, Peter Scazzaro, who pastors in the constant blizzard that is New York City, says that practices like fasting and like Lectio Divina, among others, can become essential threads in a strong rope to keep us centered and lead us home in the midst of blizzards. These things that keep us connected closely to God help us find our way in the midst of these dark nights we walk through. Remember, we don't participate to do religious things, but we participate to know God. And that's what Jesus invites us to do, to come to him. I'm going to invite the band to come back. In a couple of minutes, we're going to spend some time reflecting in song. But I want to continue to read what Isaiah wrote in chapter 40. He says, "Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." And there's the balance in that passage from Ecclesiastes. As many advantages as youthfulness has over old age, no rattling bones or stooping shoulders or teeth that don't work properly, as many advantages of youthfulness might have, it has its own downfalls. Even youths, young men, the reality is that spiritual fatigue is something that every one of us will experience. How will we come through it? Close with a reading from the Catholic writer John Henry Newman, and then we'll sing a couple of songs in response. "Lead, kindly light, amid the encircling gloom, lead thou me on. The night is dark, and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. Keep thou my feet. I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me."